Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Dr. Seuss wasn't considering baseball fans when he first published his best-selling book, Oh, the Places You'll Go. He left that for Josh Behagian to deal with. Behagian first published 101 Baseball Places to See Before You Strike Out in 2010, following a joint venture with Kevin O'Connell, Ultimate Baseball Road Trip, A Fan's Guide to Major League Stadiums. But because nothing lasts forever, Behagian has updated 101 Baseball Places due to the closing of some venues from the initial publication, and to include a few and exciting items that have superseded older ones, included the first time around.
Josh Behagian, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me, Ron. It's great to be back.
So you have a new edition of your 101 Places People Must Visit in Baseball, and could you tell us why, when did the first one come out, first of all?
Sure. The first edition came out in 2008, and readers seemed to enjoy it. It kind of followed up on one of my other books, The Ultimate Baseball Road Trip, a good book to have with you as you're traveling around the country and looking to explore some of baseball's neat places, but hopefully also a book that's good if you're homebound or just like to be sort of the armchair traveler. You can also learn about and see nice color pictures of some of baseball's interesting places just from sitting and perusing it. So hopefully it's a fun book for readers.
Now, the 101 places, are they ranked?
They are ranked, and that was difficult for me. It's admittedly a subjective thing. I think few folks would quibble with, like, the top 10, but once you get past that, everyone's tastes are so diverse, and the book really pulls together so many different types of sites. There's everything in here from sites at current big league parks, like, for example, the Green Monster from Fenway is one of the sites. The water fountain in Kansas City. So you have those types of sites. You have past parks that are no longer functional, like League Park in Cleveland, but that have been preserved, or Rickwood Field in Birmingham that only hosts that one game a year, the Rickwood Classic. It's got pop culture landmarks like the Field of Dreams movie site or the Bull Durham. Durham Athletic Park, where they filmed that. It's got some really odd curios, like a banyan tree in Hawaii that Babe Ruth planted in the 30s that is still growing and still attracts visitors. So it's got so many different types of sites that I admit it's completely subjective. I tried to rank them in order of what are most interesting to the average fan, but as I'm sure you know, everyone, there is no real average. Everyone's a little different. So I'm welcoming to fans who want to argue with how I've ranked them. If you have a favorite site that's ranked 50th, it doesn't mean it's not the best. It just means when I was putting together the rankings, I based it on my preferences.
Now, the last time we spoke, I asked you if you had been to each of these places. Have you been to each of these places?
I've been to all of these except for the two in Hawaii and the one in Alaska. I still have not made it out of the continental USA, unfortunately. And that's really just a budget thing more than anything else. But I've been to 98 out of the 101, so I hope that counts for something. I hope fans and readers don't mind me including those few that I haven't been to. I've spoken, obviously, to folks who have been to the Midnight Classic, Midnight Sun Game up in Fairbanks, Alaska, where they play this game at an amateur field in the Alaska Summer League at midnight. They play through the night and don't have to turn on the ballpark lights. And it's such a neat attraction. I just couldn't leave it out of the book. And then the sites in Hawaii, Alexander Joy Cartwright's grave, one of the people who is a forefather of baseball, I wouldn't say the only one. He's buried in Hawaii, and then also that Babe Ruth banyan tree is in Hawaii, and another neat site that a few people I know who have visited and took some photos for me, and I wanted to include in the book. So, full disclosure on that, those three sites I have not yet been to, but someday hopefully I will.
Could you just describe the Babe Ruth Banyan tree? What is that?
Yeah, sure. It's the Hilo Hawaii Walk of Fame on the Big Island. And back in the 1930s, there was a movement there to create this landmark. You know, it was kind of like a man-made landmark that would sorry, my wife's cell phone's ringing. I apologize. Anyway, they were creating this landmark where they would plant trees, and folks like FDR.
Excuse me, Josh. I'm going to have to edit that part out, so let's
yeah, can you do
over.
That? I'm sure, sorry. I was sure. In the room with the door shut and a phone in the closet started ringing. Heather, can you get your cell phone? Is it okay to edit that, Ron?
Yeah, sure. So just let me know when you're ready, and I'll ask the question.
Yeah, okay. Sorry about that. So anyway, if you could ask the question.
You ready?
Yeah.
All right, could you just explain what the Babe Ruth Banyan tree is?
Yeah, sure. It's on the Big Island in Hawaii. It's the Hilo Walk of Fame, it's called. And back in the 1930s, there was a movement to create a landmark, the Hilo Parks Commission, back then, because they had so many visitors just discovering the islands. It was a popular stopover point when folks were on their way to Japan, especially. So folks like FDR, Amelia Earhart, King George, years later Richard Nixon, they would stop by, and when they visited the town, they would plant a tree along this coastal drive along a peninsula there in Hilo. And Babe Ruth, of course, went to Japan a couple times on barnstorming tours during baseball's off season, and he stopped in Hawaii, and when he did, he planted this tree. It was just a little seedling at the time, and as the years passed, the storms and ravages of Mother Nature destroyed a lot of the trees along the walk. But one of the ones that survived is the one that Babe Ruth planted. So it's this huge tree now. It's many feet wide. It takes a little while to walk around it. I don't know if you've seen banyan trees, but they really just like sprawl out and become these massive, massive natural structures. And Babe Ruth's tree is still there. There's a little sign in front of it. Babe Ruth planted this tree in 1933. And it's one of those landmarks that just sort of, you know, became more than you might have imagined, 80, 90 years ago now. So that's one really neat site in the book.
Now, for every new thing that you put in, you have to take something out. So what were some of the things that had to go and why?
Sure, good question. Some literally had to go because they didn't exist anymore. Like back in the first edition of the book, there was a car wash owned and operated by Lenny Dykstra, who was kind of still a popular and well-looked-upon figure at the time. He had recently retired and was writing columns for TheStreet.com and had kind of made that transition from baseball player to businessman. And then fast forward a couple of years, he wound up in jail, and I think for some financial doings that were not fully legitimate, and his car wash is closed, so that one had to go. Another one would be like Ozzie Smith's sports bar in St. Louis closed. So there were some that just closed and went away. There were others that I thought no longer were as interesting to fans as some of the newer sites that had opened. For example, like the Balco Lab site out in California, like at the time when the PED revelations were coming out, I thought it was, you know, not a place to celebrate, but a place important for folks to reflect on and, like, go to the place where all these players had, gotten their illegal substances. But as other places opened, I said, okay, well, that's not really a site I should include in this book. Another one would be the Alcor Life Extension Foundation, the sort of fringe scientific place in Scottsdale, Arizona, where Ted Williams's severed head currently still resides in some mixture of chemicals, because that's where he wound up instead of a grave site, which fans can visit. And through the book, you can explore Babe Ruth's grave or Jackie Robinson's grave and a number of other players who you can actually go and pay your respects and see where they rest. There's no such place for Ted Williams, so at the time, I included the Alcor Labs for Ted Williams, but in hindsight, I thought, well, that's not really a place fans want to go, so I included Ted Williams' boyhood home in San Diego this time instead, which has become something of a tourist attraction. So I made some selective decisions like that, but others were of necessity just because they didn't exist anymore.
Now, in fact, there are a few other restaurants that have been cut for the same reason, that they've closed down. Mickey Mantle's restaurant, DiMaggio's Chop House, Ryan's had a steakhouse that shut down.
Yeah.
I know it used to be a thing for when players retired to still cash in on their names. They would open restaurants. Is that kind of not a thing anymore?
I mean, I could think of some examples where it still is, like here in the Boston market where I am, north of Boston in Maine. You know, we still have Jerry Remy's down in Boston, and we still have a Big Poppy restaurant, but it seems like one of those fleeting things. I know Daryl Strawberry had one at Last Check in New York, but I purposely included far fewer of those places in the book this time around, just because realizing their lack of permanence and that there is not as much continuity in them, I decided to go a little lighter on them. I did still include Bobby Valentine's in Stamford, Connecticut, because that's a sports bar that's been around for more than 20 years and seems pretty well established. And I did still include, it's not quite a restaurant, but Mike Greenwell's amusement park. Former Red Sox left fielder Mike Greenwell has an amusement park down in Fort Myers, Florida, that's especially popular for tourists during spring training. So I still included that. It's been around for years. But I went a little lighter on the restaurants and player-owned sites just for that reason.
Now what about ballparks that are starting to incorporate their own museums? Like you list there's a Yankee Museum in the new Yankee Stadium. Is that another way that teams are trying to reach out to fans who might not be interested in the actual game on the field, but just trying to drum up some way of generating more interest in the game?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a way to really try to root fans in the team's history, you know, especially, you know, I think it's especially nice for someone who doesn't know so much about the game's history. They could show up at the park, and it's not going to be as comprehensive a history lesson as, you know, reading multiple books about the team, but if you can walk through and see an old World Series trophy or some of the artifacts related to the team's early days, you know, I think it does sort of tie you a little bit more to the team. The Yankee Stadium one is very well done. The Braves have a really neat one. I know they're going to be moving ballparks in a couple of years to the new one they're building in Cobb County, but theirs is really neat because it spans multiple iterations of the team, from the Boston Braves to the Milwaukee Braves to the Atlanta Braves. They encompass all three eras. So that's really neat. But, yeah, those museums I like a lot. There are also museums dedicated to specific players. Like there's a Shoeless Joe Jackson Library and Museum down in Greenville, South Carolina. There's a Ty Cobb Museum down in Royston, Georgia. There's a Bob Feller Museum out in Iowa, a Cy Young Museum in Ohio, and I've included those in the book. And those are, I think, really fun spots to see the players sometimes, not just in what they did for the game, but what they did in their life. You see artifacts related to the years before they became big stars and afterwards. You get to see the old photos and newspaper clippings, you know, related to when they were first coming up through the high school ranks. And then also you get to learn a little bit about their after baseball years. So those places I like a lot too. So there are a good number of museums in the book.
Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? I don't know. I guess even though it's oddly placed, I kind of like the Ted Williams Hitters Hall of Fame down in St. Petersburg. It seems odd that a Ted Williams Hall of Fame would not be located like at Fenway Park or something. But Ted wasn't from that part of the country. He was from San Diego originally, but he settled in his retirement years down in Florida and originally had a museum separate up in Hernando, Florida. But when that went sort of belly up after he died, it became absorbed by the Tampa Bay Rays. And that's a neat one for just that reason I was saying. You get to see aspects of Ted Williams away from the game. You get to see stuffed fish and fishing gear from his exploits in the Florida Keys, where he was a master fisherman. You get to see old photos and artifacts from his days as a fighter pilot during World War II and the Korean War. And, you know, that just rounds out, for me, it rounds out the player and shows you, you know, that every person lives this life that we see in the spotlight in the game, but also this, you know, this other fuller life that we all have. So that would probably be my one favorite if I had to pick one.
Okay, you told us about your favorite. What do you think is the most unusual entry in this book?
The most unusual? I would go with the Simpson statues, Homer and Marge and Bart and Lisa, out at Isotopes Park in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I don't know if you watched the show The Simpsons, Ron, but there have been a few episodes that have involved the local minor league baseball team, the Springfield Isotopes. And back in 2003, there was an episode where the beloved local team, the Springfield Isotopes, were thinking about moving, relocating cities to Albuquerque. And just a little bit of synchronicity, a year later, the Albuquerque city was establishing a new team, and they were trying to come up with a name for the new team, and everyone had kind of latched onto that Simpsons name. So they had a fan contest, and like two-thirds of people voted for Albuquerque Isotopes, just like it had been in The Simpsons. So they created that name, and for years they kind of existed separate from The Simpsons identity. And the general manager a few years back was in Los Angeles for a Dodgers playoff game, because the AAA Albuquerque Isotopes are affiliated with the Dodgers, and he was there with his wife to watch a game, and his name is John Traub. And while they were in town, they went to an antique store, and sure enough, there was a Homer Simpson statue. And fast forward a year, and they had brought the statue and a few others across the Southwest to their ballpark and refurbished the statues and put them on the concourses. So now, as you're walking around Isotopes Park, you see these statues, colorful statues of the Simpsons, which just sort of a weird merger of pop culture and America's national game.
Very meta, very meta. We've been talking with Josh Behagian, author of the second edition of 101 Baseball Places to See Before You Strike Out, published by Lions Press. Josh, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, Ron.
And that was our conversation with Josh Behagian. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Bennett Jacobstein, author of the new book, The Joy of Ballpark Food, From Hot Dogs to Haute Cuisine. And remember to visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf regularly for updates on your favorite topic, baseball books, and the places they reside. Thanks again, everybody. See you next time.
Said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.